A couple minutes past midnight on February 3rd, 1943, the U.S. Dorchester, which was a transport ship, was transporting 904 soldiers, tons and tons of supplies that armies would need. It was heading to England, inevitably, supplies like tanks and jeeps and half-tracks and lots of food. In a few minutes before midnight on February 3rd, 1943, only 100 miles from Greenland, a torpedo ripped through the hull of that ship. The ship sank within 30 minutes into the freezing water and air temperature. I told you there were 904 people that were aboard. 678 of those perished. Among the lost were four chaplains: Alexander Good, John P. Washington, George Fox, and Clark Poling. Now, George Fox was born in 1900 in Lewiston, Pennsylvania. He attended Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. He was a highly decorated World War I medic. He married, he fathered two kids. Another one of the chaplains that was on board, Clark Poling, was a Dutch Reform pastor. He grew up in the home of a pastor and a writer. He was from Columbus, Ohio. In 1910, he received undergraduate education at a denominational school and divinity training at Yale University. And like Fox, he was a family man, blessed with a wife and kids. 40 men among the 226 survivors provided testimony to what happened when this ship was sinking. According to the official Army historian, they told of the around-the-clock ministry of the faithful shepherds that had visited the sick, led worship, sang with men aboard the ship in informal gatherings before that fateful night. Quoting a Red Cross source, historian Robert Guchwa wrote, "They also told how, with utter disregard of self, having given away their own life jackets that very day, the chaplain stood hand in hand praying to God that they serve for the safety of those men who were leaving the stricken ship on all sides of them." You see, these four men made a decision, a moral decision, to protect the men that were on this ship, the people that were on it. They gave their own life jackets away. And not only did they give their own life jackets away, they helped people into the very few boats that they had left. And what they found out at the end of it, there was not enough room in that boat. That's a Dorchester right there. And this was the United States stamp for those four men. The idea of chaplains in World War II is something that very few people talk about. In the Italian campaign in the Easter Sunday of 1944, the 349th Infantry of the 88th Division had dug in near a German front about halfway up the Italian peninsula, just below Rome. And as soon as word went out that the 349th would be online, the regimental commander and the regimental chaplain executed a bold plan for the men at the front. A forward observer wrote, "Originally the idea was to set up loudspeakers to make the Christian service audible to everyone. However, since the companies were directly in front of the enemy positions, it was impossible to get the services over to them without being heard by the enemy, the Germans. After a brief discussion, it was decided to open the service up in German because the Christian religion is for all races and nations, for enemies as well as friends. The chaplains, some of who spoke fluent German, determined to hold a short German service for the enemy soldiers at the very start. On Easter Eve, regimental soldiers laid wire and set up loudspeakers. Rear echelon personnel, including nurses, made their way to the front to worship and to observe. Early on Resurrection Day, Chaplain Reinbauth, a Missouri Synod Lutheran minister of German descent, began to read the traditional service in both German and English. Words of scripture and praise broadcast out by the loudspeakers across the 400 yards of devastated no man's land between the Germans and the Americans. After reading the gospel in German, Reinbauth cried out, 'Should not all Christendom be jubilant this day? Should not all people rejoice now that Christ died and rose again for all men, for Germans and Americans alike? Therefore, I wish you also today, in the name of my soldiers, a happy Easter.'" A UPI correspondent stood among the singular congregation and witnessed that through powerful telescopes there would be no signs of movement on the German line whatsoever. Their guns had not spoken since the ceremonies began. Gradually, however, men began to slowly move forward and gather around a small altar that had been carried up by mule pack in the early dark in the morning. The first lieutenant, Charlotte Johnson, who is a nurse from Ohio, sang, "I know that my Redeemer lives," which happened to be composed by German-born George Friedrich Handel. These are unique moments in world war where people we don't hear about a lot, pastors, chaplains. Chaplains played a critically important role in World War II. Can you imagine how the gospel was received by soldiers facing their imminent death? Do you think that people actually showed up for church when the chaplain in Italy or Germany or France or anywhere else for that matter said, "Let's open God's word and let's see what God has to say about all of this"? Faith was important in World War II. And one of the men that I interviewed, his name is gunner's mate Loy Smith. His son is in our audience today. And Loy Smith served in the Pacific Theater. He was at Iwo Jima, if you know what that battle was like. And it was a tough battle where many, many men died. I had the opportunity to chat with him about his faith, because when he went and got on that ship to serve the United States, he was a born-again Christian. And I wanted to know, what was that like? How important was your faith? So if you guys have it, would you roll it?
I was going to get drafted in the Army, and I didn't want to go in the Army, so I joined the Navy. There was 29,000 people killed between February the 19th and March the 10th. There are 22,000 Japanese that have families, probably, at home that they're not going to.
Did you feel like God was protecting you?
Yes, I did. Oh, yes. Very much so. Very much. In fact, that instant, I always felt that way. I feel that way today.
When you think about your time in World War II, and if you had your grandson here, one of your great-grandkids, and you were going to teach them a spiritual lesson of what happened in World War II, what's a spiritual lesson that you would want them to know?
I want them to live their life for Christ, for people to see, not just a secret Christian, you know. But there's people that I've known for years, maybe. "I didn't know you were a Christian." I'm not ashamed, you know. I never have been.
So that's part of probably about an hour I spent with Loy, and what a remarkable man. You know what he's doing this morning? He teaches adult Sunday school, if you didn't know it, for about 60 people at his church up in Lakewood. And he has been faithful to the Lord most all of his life. His stories of what he experienced and what he saw on Iwo Jima are chilling. But I'm here to tell you that that man's faith in Christ walked him through probably the most difficult moments of his life. Today we're going to discuss a very difficult topic, and that's the rise of the Third Reich, the rise of Adolf Hitler. We're going to be faced with questions today that are going to be difficult, questions about morality, and more specifically, morality in government and its effect upon culture through the propaganda manifested through education, the government itself, and the church. These decisions that were made caused deadly and catastrophic results, not only in Germany, but throughout the world. Morality is an important word. Morality means that they were looking at the principles concerning the distinctions between what is right and wrong, what is good and bad behavior. It would be good for us to reflect upon our own lives and on our own country, maybe for a moment, before entering the world of Nazi Germany. Especially today, since American moral standards are certainly dynamic, they're changing. Many issues divide us as a nation, from abortion, family values, gay rights, and euthanasia, just to mention a few. Conventional wisdom dictates that morality cannot be legislated. That's what it says. Government can't legislate morality. No one should force their morals upon anyone else. And as long as I don't hurt anyone else, the government should leave me alone. Whatever consenting adults do, it's okay. Being a pluralistic society, we fundamentally disagree on value, so that means there's no commonality. So legislative morality won't work because the government can't force people to do something called good. And now the question is, are all those propositions true? Let's enter into the world of Adolf Hitler as we think about the answers to those questions. On your outline, you can see that Adolf Hitler was born on April 20th, 1889. He was born in a small Austrian town called Braunau on the Inn River, and it's along the Austrian and German border. And I think I've got a map here for us to look at. So you can see right there where I've put the pin. The Inn River is right here in Braunau, and what it does, it forms a border between Germany and Austria, and also a little bit further down, the Czech Republic. Adolf Hitler was born in this little community. It's probably about 70 miles to Munich, where he'll get his launch right here, and probably about 120 miles over here to Vienna, where he'll spend a lot of his early. But I wanted you to see this on a map so you have context for where this man grew up and what he's thinking, because we're going to talk about that in a moment. This is his birth house, basically what that says in front of you. This is where he was born, and we've learned a lesson that cost millions of people their lives. When we look at Adolf Hitler, he's born in Austria, right on the Austrian-German border. He was the son of an extremely strong-willed Austrian custom official. His early youth seems to be controlled by his father until his father's death in 1903. His dad was kind of that absentee father guy that was hanging out with the bar with his buddies and didn't really spend a lot of time with his son or his daughter. Hitler's parents had, I think, altogether six children. Four of them died at birth. And Adolf Hitler and his sister were the only ones that survived through adulthood among the Hitler children. Adolf Hitler left formal education altogether in 1905, and he began long years of aimless existence, reading, painting in the woods, and dreaming, and he dreamt of becoming a famous artist. These paintings I'm showing you are painted by Adolf Hitler. This is one of them. And here's a picture of a painting he did of Mary with Christ. And matter of fact, if you caught the news today, they had an auction this weekend of 10 of his paintings altogether. And guess how much they sold for? Nothing. No one bought one of the paintings whatsoever. In 1907, when his mother died, he moved to the city of Vienna. And it was an attempt to enroll in the famed Academy of Fine Arts. His failure to gain admission that year and the next led him into a period of depression and drifted away from his friends. He tries to get into this prestigious Academy of Art. He thinks he could be an artist. He tries two times, and he's rejected both of those times. Now, if you know anything about art, and you can see some of his watercolors and that, and you know something about art, you can understand why the Academy didn't have him come be a student there. Not only does that happen for him, but his mother also dies in that same time period. His mom, he was very close to. She got breast cancer. She was treated actually by a Jewish doctor. And there's a lot of discussion about, you know, this Jewish doctor. But this Jewish doctor turned out to be a really sharp, state-of-the-art guy and did everything to save Hitler's mother's life. But the cancer was metastasized and had gone too far. So here's a guy who lost his mother that he was very close to, rejected from going into the school he wanted. So his failure caused some changes in him. He was particularly impressed by the successes of the anti-Semitic nationalist Christian Socialist Party, and that was run by the Vienna mayor, Karl Lueger. Hitler began to develop an extreme anti-Semitism at this point and a racial mythology that were to remain to his own ideology for the rest of his life. In May 1913, Hitler moved to Munich. After the outbreak of World War, a year later, he volunteered for action in the German army in their war against the European powers in America. It was one of the happiest days of his life was when the Germans declared war on the French and also on the English. He had a chance to actually serve and to fight. He really did not excel well in the army. During the war, he fought on the Western Front, as most people did, with a distinction, but gained no promotion beyond the rank of corporal. He was injured two different times, and he won several awards for bravery, among them the highly respected Iron Cross. Basically, what he was is a runner. He had people that were giving him information, you know, and then the information needed to be brought to the front. And so he was just bringing information back and forth. His role was corporal, and he was never promoted beyond corporal, one of the lowest ranks that you could have in the army altogether. At the end of the war, Hitler was left without a place or a goal, and it drove him to join many veterans who continued to fight in the streets of Germany. One of the things that they asked him to do, because he needed money and the economy was bad, was he continued working in the army, and he was kind of a snitch for the army. The Kaiser was dethroned. Remember, we talked about how all of these kings and queens were tossed out, and now new governments were coming in. So the army had to have ways of figuring out, okay, which government's a good government, which one's not, and Hitler's first job was to kind of go figure it out. You're going to find out a little bit later on, he goes to a socialist meeting and he's there as a spy for the government and ends up liking a lot of the ideas that the Socialist Party has and ends up joining them. In the spring of 1919, he found employment, like I said, as a political officer in the army. That was with the help of Ernst Röhm. Later, Röhm went on to be one of his elite soldiers, part of the stormtroopers, the SA. In this capacity, Hitler attended a meeting of the so-called German Workers' Party, a nationalist, anti-Semitic, and socialist group. He did that in September of 1919. He quickly distinguished himself as the party's most popular and impressive speaker and propagandist, and he helped to increase the membership dramatically to some 6,000 by 1921. He found out something by speaking, and he didn't realize he had a gift as an orator. And he started speaking, and people encouraged him and said, you know, Adolf, you're pretty good at speaking. And it was something that launched his career. In April of that year, he became what's called the Führer. Führer means leader of the renamed National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP. Let's look at that. National Socialist. D is Deutsche. It's so German. A stands for Arbeit, Arbeiter. That's the workers' party, and it became the official name of the Nazi party, National Socialists, and the short for the National Socialist was Nazi. The poor economic conditions of the following year contributed to the rapid growth of the party. By the end of 1923, Hitler would count on following of some 56,000 members and many more sympathizers. He regarded himself as a strong force in the Bavarian and German political scene. Hitler hoped to use the crisis conditions to stage his own overthrow of the Bavarian government. He staged what's called the Nazi Beer Hall Putsch. That happened on November 8th and 9th, 1923, for which he hoped to force the conservative nationalist Bavarian government, which is mostly run by the Roman Catholics in the area, to cooperate with him on a march on Berlin. The attempt failed. Hitler is tried for high treason. He is sentenced to 5 years in a minimum security prison in Landsberg. Landsberg is just west of Munich. He was actually in front of the judge, and most of the other people that were in front of the judge repented And they said, hey, we're really sorry. And guess what the judge did? He let them go. They went to Adolf Hitler and said, do you repent? He goes, no way. He goes, this government stinks. It's horrible. It's full of corruption. Throw the book at me. And they sent him to prison for 5 years. Now, the prison he went to was a minimum security castle. And he had a suit and tie and entertained people from his party all the time. He was out in less than a year. So he never served all 5 years. But what happens for him in prison that's really important is he outlines his major plans and beliefs in a book called Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf. So Mein Kampf in German means my struggle. My struggle. And he dictated that to his loyal confidant, another guy that you may know, Rudolf Hess. So this whole idea of Hitler, and we're just going to look at his life just up to a certain point, right up to the 1920s in the biography part, is a man in transformation. And he is a nationalist and a socialist. Think about that. Nationalist, socialist, Deutsche Arbeiter. Isn't that confusing? Nationalist is a right-wing terminology, right? Socialist is that's a left-wing thing. And then the next word is Deutsche, back to national again. And then Arbeiters, oh, back to left-wing. So it's partially left-wing and it's partially right-wing. And you can see in this picture I have here that I found, this is the announcement that war has been declared against the Allies. And this is the Platz in Munich, in the old city, in the Altstadt. And you see that I've circled it there for you. And who's waving his hat in delight for the beginning of World War I? Do you recognize that guy? It's none other than Adolf Hitler. So this idea of Hitler and the origins of what happens next in the National German Socialist Party becomes really important. So let's look for a little bit about how this Nazi party and how it is that Adolf Hitler moved through all of this and rose to the top of the table. Hitler's appearances and party activities drew attention in 1920 and 22, but the party was relatively small and confined mostly to Munich. This is a really good picture for you to think about in the 20s and in the 30s. So this is the German Republic. Look at how big Bavaria is. Do you see Bavaria right here? This is where Adolf Hitler's base was here. This also, religiously, is all Roman Catholic. Now, the rest of the Weimar Republic, the rest of Germany, and this is the parts of Prussia and parts of Prussia that they were allowed to keep after the Versailles Treaty, all of this is Protestant. So you have groups right here that are conservative Catholics, and then here you have more conservative Protestants. And those Protestants are both Calvinists, and they're also Lutheran. So that's an important thing to keep in the back of your mind. So Hitler denounces the Treaty of Versailles. Remember how one-sided the Treaty of Versailles was and that the Germans would have to pay for reparations? And by them paying for reparations, it basically starts to just bankrupt their entire economic system. He also outlined an anti-Semitic program under which citizenship would be limited to those of German blood. Hyperinflation crippled Germany in the early 20s. So what you had this hyperinflation that was kind of crazy. And I think I've got a picture for you here. There we go. You can see this lady is selling things at her store. Eine Brot, that's bread, 50,000 marks at the time. You see how people got paid during this time of hyperinflation? The Americans started lending money to the Germans. They also were taking money from the French and the English, were coming into America to pay for reparations. It was going right into Germany, but it still wasn't enough for them to repay everything. So German politicians thought, oh, the best idea for us? Let's print more money. Let's tax people. Let's cut employment. Let's kill small business. That will work really well. Do you see this man? He's in a bank, and all of those are Deutsche Marks, all of them. Because what happened is hyperinflation got so bad that in 1914, before World War I, $1 would get you 6 Deutschmarks. By the end of World War I, $1 would get you 42 Deutschmarks. By the time of hyperinflation, one American dollar would get you a trillion. So what would happen is you would go to work in the morning, and you'd be at work, and your wife would come with you, and she would look at your employer, and your employer would pay you in the morning. Your employer, matter of fact, would pay you 3 times in a day during this time period. Pay in the morning so your wife could go out and buy lunch. Because when the stock market opened, what you got paid, right, is that value is going to go down, and the amount of a $1 towards a mark is going to go up. So you would get paid in the morning, your wife would go out and buy all kinds of groceries, and then your wife would come back just before lunch, so she would get money to buy things for dinner, and then she would be back at dinner to buy things for the following breakfast, because the stock market would close at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so you'd be relatively safe over the evening to do it. Think about that for a second. Kids were using Deutsche Marks with scissors and just cutting them, and people were pasting them, and they were art projects, and they made kites out of it. Their currency became worthless. You can see here with this gal, and then finally they didn't like the idea of stacking it up, so they came up with this. This is a 50, means 50. It's a $50 billion mark. Can you imagine that? At one time, to go from the west side of Berlin to the center of what's now eastern Berlin would cost a rider 12 million marks just to take the bus ride over. So this presented an opportunity for other political parties to jump in. Do you think people were happy to live in this kind of economic climate? It's no way. So in November 1923, Hitler and his followers conspired to seize power in Bavaria. We just talked about that in the March on Berlin, and it was a beer hall push. And this is why they did it. They saw opportunity economically to step up to the front of the stage and say, hey, we could take over. Hitler's claimed leadership of the party after his release from prison continued on. And this is where Mein Kampf becomes pretty important. Let me read to you some of the manifestos from Mein Kampf. Let's talk about God first and views of God. Adolf Hitler, this is a topic, acting according to God's will. Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 2. Quote, I believe today that my conduct is in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator. Adolf Hitler thanking God. Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 5. Quote, even today I'm not ashamed to say that, overpowered by stormy enthusiasm, I fell down on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time in history. Adolf Hitler, Deutschland über alles. Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 5, quote, I had so often sung Deutschland über alles and shouted Heil at the top of my lungs that it seemed to me almost a belated act of grace to be allowed to stand as a witness in the divine court of the eternal judge and proclaim the sincerity of his conviction. Adolf Hitler on Russia. Do you remember I told you at the beginning of World War II, there was a non-aggression treaty between the Soviet Union and Germany? They were on the same team, if you would like. They should have read Mein Kampf, because in Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler not only talks about his plans for Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, talks about what he's going to do also to the French. Quote, never forget that the rulers of the present day Russia are common bloodstained criminals, that they are the scum of humanity which, favored by circumstances, overran a great state in a tragic hour. They slaughtered out thousands of her leading intelligentsia in wild bloodlust, and now for almost 10 years have been carrying on the most cruel and tyrannical regime of all time. In Russian Bolshevism, we must see the attempt undertaken by the Jews in the 20th century to achieve world domination. Germany is today the next great aim of Bolshevism. If we pursue this aim, it's sheer lunacy to ally ourselves with a power whose master is the mortal enemy of our future. How can we expect to free our own people from the fetters of this poisonous embrace if we walk right into it? How shall we explain Bolshevism to the German worker as an accursed crime against humanity if we ally ourselves with organizations of this spawn of hell, thus recognizing it in the larger sense? We must take over Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. To further German population growth, Hitler rejected the ideas of birth control as well in Mein Kampf and emigration, arguing that practices like that weaken the people and the culture of Germany, and that the military conquest was the only means for Lebensraum. Remember that word last week? Lebensraum means living room, means more space for us. The National Socialist Movement, on the contrary, will always let its foreign policy be determined by the necessity to secure the space necessary to live for us Germans. It will never see in the subjugated so-called Germanized Czechs or Poles a national, let alone focused strengthening, but only the racial weakening by embracing these people as our folk. He goes on to talk about France. But in order to achieve this, and this being the ultimate goal in his foreign policy in Mein Kampf, Germany must first defeat its old enemy, France. Do you think it would have been a good idea that someone should have fact-checked this, like in 1934 or so? You think the French government or the Soviets may have read some of this? Germany must first defeat its old enemy, France. And that's to avenge the German defeat of World War I and to secure the western border. Hitler bitterly recalls the end of World War I, saying the German army was denied its chance for victory on the battlefield by political treachery at home. He attaches most of the blame to Jewish conspirators in a highly menacing and even more threatening tone. Mein Kampf was basically the playbook for World War II. Anyone that read it and knew if this guy came to power, this was his intention. I summed it up here. That Germany would dominate the entire European continent. Britain would continue to have its global empire. Adolf Hitler believed that when he went into France, he thought there would be a chance that the English, who did not like the French, would align with the Germans. And there were a number of people that believed that. The United States would be the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, but Hitler believed that the United States would eventually collapse because of its racial heterogeneity. And this idea that there's so many different types of people and diversity is king. And Hitler said, well, with diversity being king and you have that this is never going to work long term. No way. And fourthly, that Japan would dominate much of Asia. These are the principles that come from Mein Kampf. Now, there was another economic collapse that we need to look at that caused Hitler to come onto the mainstream, and that's the Great Depression. Do you remember I told you that the Americans were lending money to the Germans? So they were lending money to both the government and also to private enterprise in Germany. And they were doing it at high interest rates. Americans are making a lot of money off of it. And then the German government and those businesses, what were they doing with the money? They were also lending it all out. So what happens is when the American economy and the stock market crashes, everybody crashes. First phone calls from America to Germany are, we're calling the loans in. We want our money back. And Germans are calling the people they lent the money to going, we want our money back. And nobody had a capacity to pay whatsoever. So the pictures you see of the Great Depression in America are the same pictures that you would see in Germany. People living in shanties, selling apples, pencils, and this provided something called opportunity. You see on your outline, it says that there was an issue that Hitler, that his party was looking for, a great issue, and they found it. They founded in the Great Depression of 1929. It brought a stunning drop in industrial production, a sharp increase in unemployment, a spiraling government deficit. Hitler and the Nazis waged an aggressive campaign in the fall of 1930, and they stunned observers by becoming the second largest party in Germany, gaining 18% of the vote. Now stop for a second. Remember, there's lots and lots of parties. This isn't like America where we'd say 18%. That guy's a loser. This is a parliamentary government. And you form coalitions with other people that have like-minded ideas. If you can get 35 or 38% of the vote, you might be that person. Here I put up an election for you of 1932. It's coming out on the back end of it. One of the things that the Nazis were able to say to the people were, hey, you know what? We're a new party. You see these conservative Catholics? They have led you to ruin. They've taken you down this highway that's horrible. And you see these democratic socialists over here? They're horrible too. Look at their track record. And the thing is that the Nazis didn't have a track record. So they were kind of the new guys on the street going, hey, give us a shot. We think our ideas are better than those. Look at the ideas they've had. They've ruined our country. And they've ruined you. In this election in 1932, you can see that Hitler, with 230 seats, won and had 37% of the people. Now, that's a little bit over a third of the people in Germany thought this guy would be a good guy. So mathematically, it means two-thirds of the German people didn't vote for him either. But in a parliamentary government, this worked out well for him. He was able to form a coalition. Paul von Hindenburg, if you know that name, he was the token president at the time Hitler becomes the chancellor. Two different roles in Germany. The president, Paul von Hindenburg, he's kind of like a king. You know, he's a parliamentary guy that kind of hangs out, and he doesn't have the same power that a chancellor does. Eventually, what happens is that Hitler, when he gets enough power, he is going to make a lot of decisions, and he's going to enact some constitutional law that allow him to make decisions outside of Hindenburg and outside of Parliament. Look with me on the outline here for a second. The economy worsens in September 30 and 32, and high unemployment we talked about, shanty towns, bankruptcies. On March 21st, 33, Hitler's sworn in as a chancellor in a large ceremony at the Garrison Church. It doesn't stand any longer. The Garrison Church is in Potsdam outside of Berlin and was a victim of Allied bombing in World War II. Another event happens that's kind of curious. On February 27th, the Reichstag, that's the Congress building, catches on fire. Hitler uses that and claims that the communists had started the fire. And with what's called the Reichstag fire decree, he ends all civil liberties in Germany. This becomes the legal foundation of the Third Reich, the Third Government. Hitler called for the passage of the Enabling Act to give him full powers. And that Enabling Act is what I was explaining to you before. Here's an action where a government official says, I can do whatever I want to do. And it effectively becomes a full dictator. In July, the Nazis outlawed all parties except for the Nazi Party, thus creating a one-party state. Let's see what that election looks like. I have the election results right here. You don't have election parties at your home, and you're not going to hear somebody on television go, well, you know, we're ready to give the state of Arkansas over to Adolf Hitler. Nothing like that. It's just one person, one candidate, and this is the way it ran from 1933 until the end of World War II. The Nazis thus created a one-party state at Hindenburg's death. Hitler assumed the office of president and chancellor. He called himself again Führer. And the army swore an oath of allegiance, not to the Constitution, not to the German Constitution at all. They swore an oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler personally. The concurrent operations of the Gestapo and the SS created a police state of unlimited power and ruthless efficiency. Hitler took the title of Führer, or leader. The period from 33 to 35 was one of early legal discrimination against the Jewish people. And that was Jewish people in civil service, overall professions, law, medicine, education, things along that line. The years 35 to 38 were characterized by the passage of the Nuremberg Laws in 35. Nazi policy in these years focused on Entjudigung, which is pressuring Jews to leave Germany altogether. The infamous Reich Kristallnacht in November 38, this is the first nationwide coordinated attack of violence against the Jewish community. Can you imagine that for a moment? That an entire government would turn against the race of one peoples and do something like this. This happened in 1938. Reminder, in 1939, Time magazine made Adolf Hitler Man of the Year. So these are the book burnings that you've seen. These happened in Berlin, where the government wanted to control universities. Yeah, interesting when governments want to control educational systems. And this is a picture I took in Berlin. This is the same spot. It's called Bibelplatz. And what's interesting about it is you have a law school, a church, opera house. So you have education, you have media, you have the church. All had front row seats to the burning of those books and burning of ideas. All right, let's talk a little bit about positive Christianity in Germany. Positive Christianity is not a good thing, okay? Just want to help you with that. It's just a name that was given. And let's talk about the influence of church in Nazi Germany. This is all before World War II. Just to keep it in the same spot for a moment here, chronologically. The population in Germany in 1933 was around 60 million people. Almost all Germans were Christians, belonging either to the Roman Catholic tradition, 20 million members, or the Protestant 40 million member churches. So you remember the map I showed you of northern Germany and Prussia? You could see why there would be 40 million people. It's a larger area. And then the southern part where Munich is Bavaria. The Jewish community in Germany in 1933 was less than 1% of the population of the country. In both the Catholic and Protestant German churches, there were members that included clergy and leading theologians who openly and sadly supported the Nazi regime. With time, anti-Nazi sentiment grew in both Protestant and Catholic circles as a Nazi regime exerted greater pressure on them. In turn, Nazi regime saw a potential for dissent in church criticism of something called state measures. Now, state measures for the church, the Nazis took the church over. I think I've got some pictures of that. So this is how they recreated the church, and we had clergymen in Germany, both Protestant and Catholic, be okay with this. Let's go backwards. So DC, Deutsche Christians, right? And so they remade the cross. Alfred Rosenberg, who lost his life in Nuremberg, he was executed by the Allies at the end of World War II, wrote the manifesto for what the church should look like in Nazi Germany. He put together the 30 points of the Reich Church. Allow me to read a couple of those to you. The National Reichschurch of Germany categorically claims the exclusive right and the exclusive power to control all churches within the borders of the Reich. It declares these to be national churches. The National Reichschurch is absolutely and exclusively in the service of but one doctrine, race and nation. The National Reichschurch is determined to exterminate irrevocably and by every means the strange and foreign Christian faiths that have been imported into Germany. The existing churches may not be architecturally altered as they represent the property of the German nation now. German culture and to a certain extent the historical development of the nations is the property of the German nation. They are not only to be valued, but they are to be preserved for the good of the country. The National Reichschurch has no scribes. There are no pastors, chaplains, or priests. But National Reich orators are to speak to them in place. National Reich Church services are held only in the evening and not in the morning. These services are to take place on Saturdays, not Sundays any longer. The National Right Church demands immediate cessation of the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany, as well as the publication of Sunday papers, pamphlets, publications, and books of religious nature. The National Right Church has to take severe measures in order to prevent Bible and other Christian publications from being imported into Germany. The National Right Church declares that to it, and therefore to the German nation, it's been decided that the Führer's Mein Kampf is the greatest of all writings and the greatest of all documents. It is conscious that this book contains and embodies the purest and truest ethics for the greatest and future life of this nation. The National Right Church has made it a sacred duty to use all its energy to popularize the co-eternal Mein Kampf and to let every German live and complete his life according to this book. The National Right Church demands that further editions of this book, whatever form they may take, be in content and exactly similar to the present popular edition. The National Right Church will clear away from its altars all crucifixes, Bibles, and pictures of saints. On the altars, there'll be nothing but Mein Kampf, which is to the German nation and therefore to God, the most sacred book, and to the left of the altar will be a sword. The National Right Church speakers must, during church services, propound this book to the congregation to the best of their knowledge and ability. The National Right Church does not acknowledge forgiveness of sins. It represents a standpoint which will always be to proclaim that a sin once committed will be ruthlessly punished by the honorable and indestructible laws of nature, and punishment will follow during the sinner's entire lifetime. The National Right Church repudiates the christening of German children, particularly the christening with water and the Holy Spirit. The parents of a child or a newborn child must only take the German oath before this altar, which is worded as followed. In the name of God, I take this holy oath that I, the father of this child and my wife, are of proven Aryan descent. As a father, I agree to bring up this child in the German spirit and as a member of the German race. The women say, in the name of God, I take this holy oath that I bore my husband a child and that I, its mother, of a proven Aryan descent. And as a mother, I swear to bring up this child in the German spirit and as a member of the German race. The German diploma can only be issued to newly born children on the strength of the German oath that was said. The marriage ceremony of German men and women will consist of taking an oath of faithfulness and placing the right hand on the sword. There will not be any unworthy kneeling in the National Right Church ceremonies. On the day of its foundation, the Christian cross must be removed from all churches, cathedrals, and chapels within the Reich. In its colonies, it must be superseded by the unconquerable symbol of the German Hakenkreuz, which you know to be the swastika. You can't legislate morality. When a protest statement was read from the pulpits of the confessing churches in May 1935, for example, Nazi authorities reacted forcefully by briefly arresting over 700 pastors. Some of those pastors were Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Do you remember Dietrich Bonhoeffer? And Martin Niemöller. And here's our friend Dietrich Bonhoeffer, member of the confessional church. He trained pastors. He encouraged them to criticize Nazism. He was banned from preaching and publishing materials. He is executed at Flossenbürg concentration camp in Flossenbürg, Germany, about 3 weeks before the end of the war. Karl Barth, a guy that we've talked about here, talks about Adolf Hitler. He was a theologian and said the enterprise of Adolf Hitler, with all of its clatter and fireworks and all of its cunning and dynamic energy, is the enterprise of an evil spirit, which is apparently allowed its freedom for a time in order to test our faith in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. After 1937, the papal encyclical Mit brennenden Sorge, with the burning concern, was read from the Catholic pulpits. The Gestapo confiscated copies from the diocesan offices throughout the country. The general tactic by the leadership of both the Protestant and Catholic churches in Germany was caution with respect to protest and compromise with the Nazi state leadership where there could be compromise. There was criticism within both churches of Nazi radicalized ideology and notions of Arianism. Movements emerged in both churches to defend church members who were considered non-Arian under new Nazi law. Yet throughout this period, there was virtually no public opposition to anti-Semitism or any readiness by church leaders to publicly oppose the regime on the issues of anti-Semitism and state-sanctioned violence against Jews. There were individual Catholics and Protestants who spoke out on behalf of Jews, and small groups within both churches that became involved in rescue and resistance activities. After 1945, the silence of church leadership and the widespread complicity of ordinary Christians compelled leaders of both churches to address issues of guilt and complicity during the Holocaust. And it's a process that continues internationally to this very day. On September 18, 1942, Pope Pius received a letter from one of his monsignors saying that, quote, "the massacre of Jews is reaching frightening proportion and forms." Later that month, Myron Taylor, who is a U.S. representative of the Vatican, also warned the Pope that Vatican's moral prestige was being injured by its silence to the European atrocities. Taylor passed a U.S. government memorandum to Pius on the 26th of September, 1942, a couple weeks later, and it outlined intelligence received from the Jewish Agency for Palestine, which said Jews from across Nazi Empire were systematically being butchered. Taylor asked if the Vatican might have any information which might tend to confirm the reports, and if they did, what the Pope might be able to do to influence public opinion against all of this. Cardinal Maglione handed Harold Tipman, an assistant, a response to the letter on the 10th of October. The note thanked Washington for passing on the intelligence and confirmed that reports of severe measures against Jews had reached the Vatican from other sources, though it had not been possible to verify the accuracy. Nevertheless, every opportunity is being taken by the Holy See, however, to mitigate the suffering of these unfortunate people. A couple months later, in December 1942, Tipman asked the Cardinal Secretary again if Pope Pius would issue a proclamation similar to the Allied Declaration against the German policy of extermination. Maglione replied that the Vatican, quote, was unable to denounce the public, particularly the atrocities as a whole. Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. This man lost his life for this. And what he saw and what he knew in his own country, he was willing to stand against evil. And the question for us today in the world that we live in, how much are we willing to stand against what is evil today? And evil is perpetuated in so many different ways and communicated to us in so many different ways. You see, it wasn't just the church, but wasn't it the universities as well during that time period, the educational area? Like the university curriculums were strictly controlled so they fit Nazi beliefs. They changed the curriculum of the universities. There was a great emphasis placed on German achievements, and any achievement made by a Jew was either ignored or derided. The theory of relativity was described as a Jewish plot to achieve world domination and reduce Germans to the level of slaves. Under the Nazi government, the university rector had the total power within the university. All parts of the leadership principle were supported by Nazis. Therefore, all university rectors were reliable Nazis who were empowered to do as they wished as long as it fit Nazi ideology. The new rector at the University of Berlin, his name is Eugene Fischer, had been a member of the Brown Shirts, the SA. who had a veterinarian background. He immediately introduced 25 new classes, new courses to do with racial sciences. And guess what? There was no one within the university who would stop him. Not one. And what the Nazis did and what the government did here was they basically took universities and changed curriculums to fit the message that they had for their culture. That happened in Germany in the 1930s. So let's talk a little bit about the war itself. This is all just a prelude. You have to figure out, how did Adolf Hitler get into the spot he got into? Well, now he's in the spot. Remember that book, Mein Kampf, the playbook? The playbook for World War II. Here it is. You see the map that's in front of us? You can see all the blue. This is all part of now this new German state. Remember Anschluss? One of the first things the Germans, they went in, they took over Austria. That got them more natural resources. That got them more men for their armies. What did they do next? They had a peace with Neville Chamberlain. And that lasted a very, very short period of time. And they walked right into this part right here, which is the Sudetenland, which is half of Czechoslovakia, which they took over as well. In the West, they did nothing. They waited. On September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland. And there is the official beginning of World War II in the European theater. We see again the Germans have got a deal at this point. Now remember, it gets tricky. The Soviet Union and Germany are going to switch teams. But right now, they are on the same team. And they carve up Poland. They have a secret agreement. The Soviets knew that Germany on September 1st was going to go into Poland. And the Russians are going to come from the other way, and they just take all of Poland and cut it right in half. Nazi propagandists were out there, falsely claimed that Poland had been planning with its allies, Great Britain and France, to encircle and dismember Germany, and that the Poles were persecuting ethnic Germans. Hitler and his group were great communicators, and they were propagandists. And what they would do, even when he was running for office, they knew that if they went into Berlin and they could talk to 20,000 voters in Berlin, they knew the next day the conservatives could talk to 20,000 people. And the day after that, the socialists could come and talk to 20,000 people. But they got the idea that maybe if we could win the small towns, those mid-sized towns that nobody goes and visits. And Adolf Hitler did something that was very unique as a campaigner. He got on airplanes. And literally, he would make up to 3 or 4 campaign stops on airplanes. Remember the campaign stops of early America? We saw people like Teddy Roosevelt on train stops, whistle stops. But here, Adolf Hitler is using technology. He can get to 5 or 6 spots in a day, and he campaigns and he campaigns and he campaigns. He's with a party that hasn't done anything. We haven't done anything to destroy our country. Give us a chance. Let us do this. Look at how bad things are. We can turn this around. That was the propaganda. Now what he's telling the people is, hey, the reason we're rolling into Poland, Poland is ready to roll into us. Now, make no mistake about it, the Polish had a nice-sized army, and they were a tough group of people, but they had no plans whatsoever to invade Germany. Matter of fact, Germany already had death camps that were set up in Dachau, and guess what they were doing there? It wasn't Jewish people at that time. It was politicians that the Nazis didn't like that they would send to Dachau and take them to death camp there. So this whole idea of the Poles starting this invasion is totally false and a lie. Hitler then used this action to launch a retaliatory campaign against Poland. The Polish army was defeated within weeks of the invasion. They used a new strategy called Blitzkrieg, lightning war. German units with more than 2,000 tanks, 1,000 planes, they broke through the Polish defenses along the border and advanced on Warsaw. They encircle Warsaw and they destroy Warsaw and the people. See, as many Jewish people that die, Ukrainians, Poles, Estonians, Russians, they all die in this bloodland as well. Warsaw surrendered to the Germans on September 27, 1939. Didn't take very long. Britain and France declare war on Germany September 3rd, 2 days after they invade. And remember what I told you about the phony war? Because the Brits and the French, they declare war on September 3rd, but they don't actually get into action for 9 months. They kind of sit out in the background and see, well, how's this all going to work out? They do have a draft. They do start getting ready somehow, but for the most part, it's not going to happen. The Soviet Union invaded Eastern Poland September 17th. That campaign against the Low Countries comes next, and France is going to last 6 weeks. Do you realize it took 6 weeks to go west? Think about that. The Germans went into Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium, ended up in Paris in absolutely no time whatsoever. Here's a picture of the attack. And if you know your history, you know where Dunkirk is up here. And you can see the Germans, as I taught you last week, everyone thought the Germans would come into France this way like they did in World War I and create the Western Front. But they went in through the Ardennes, through the forest that the French thought, oh, they could never go through this forest. Well, they got through the forest. And when they did, there was nothing between them and Paris. This large regiment of soldiers has this going into Paris. They stop here. They turn to where Dunkirk is. This is the Dunkirk area. So you've got Germans this way, and you got Germans this way. They basically form a pocket. There's no way out. And by a miracle, Adolf Hitler calls the generals and says, cease fire. I want to think about this for a second. I might want to take some of these troops and move them to the east or somewhere else. And in that time period, one of the greatest miracles of the war, Dunkirk, happens. And you could see here, I provided the Dunkirk maps, the three routes that most of those soldiers were saved by. And it was an incredible time. You can see the Dunkirk area right there. On May 10th, 1940, British and French commanders believed that German forces would attack through central Belgium, as they had in World War I, and rush forces to the Franco-Belgian border to meet the attack. There was nobody there for them. The main German attack, however, went through the Ardennes forest in southeastern Belgium, right where Luxembourg is. German tanks and infantry quickly broke through the French defensive lines and advanced to the coast. Belgium and the Netherlands surrendered in May. More than 300,000 French and British troops were evacuated from the beaches near Dunkirk. I just showed you that. They went across the English Channel to Great Britain. Paris, the French capital, fell to the Germans on June 14, 1940. There's Adolf Hitler in Paris. As part of the armistice agreement France signed, see that railroad car right there? In World War I, the French made the German generals go in that railroad car and sign an armistice. And the German historians didn't forget, and they found that same railroad car, and they marched all the French leaders into that car, and they made them sign their armistice there, made them sign a peace treaty with them, a full and complete surrender. On June 22nd, Germany occupied northern France, all of France's Atlantic coastline down to the border of Spain. A new French government was established in the town of Vichy, which was in the unoccupied southern part of France. The Vichy government, under Marshal Henri Pétain, declared neutrality in the war between Germany and Great Britain and was committed by the armistice provisions to cooperate with the Germans. How long did that take? German soldiers at the Champs-Élysées, look at that. It didn't take long. Do you see how it moves from an idea? One of the things Adolf Hitler said in Mein Kampf is, when I want to change people, I need to change their minds and the way they think, I do it slowly, in little bits and pieces, until it's too late and I've assimilated them into the way I want them to think. I asked you a question at the beginning about whether morality is something a government can legislate. And I think that's a really good question. Edmund Burke, political Irishman, said, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing at all. Tocqueville also said, "Not until I went into the churches of America and I heard her pulpits flame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great." You see, folks, laws do legislate morality. You see, everyone's advocating a political position. And if you're advocating a political position, you're legislating morality. Judging. Remember, we live in a world, don't judge us. I'm here to tell you the opposite. Judging's a really good thing. You should judge everything. Everything. Rational people who are aware of certain fundamental principles of logic and moral reasoning, hopefully driven by God's conscience that's been provided for every human being, and by the Bible if you're a Christian, qualifies you to be a judge. It would be impossible to make laws without moral judgments. We couldn't make one law unless we made moral judgments. So when you're hearing people say, "Well, you're a hater. You're a hater. Don't judge. Judging's a bad thing." They're trying to get you into their propaganda. They're trying to move your heart and mind. And I want to tell you lastly that character counts. It counts a lot. The moral content of leadership is provided by the leader himself. You see, you can be an effective leader and have very poor character. The guy we were studying today was very effective. People followed him because of his leadership skills, but the direction they followed was determined by his character. Public character cannot be separated from private character. The leader's entire life is an example to the nation, to his family, to his children. Being a good moral example is part of the leader's job. It's a crazy notion to think that leaders, what they do in their private life, has no consequence to their public life. That flies in the face of common sense, doesn't it? Why should a leader that can't be trusted by his family be trusted by a nation? Character counts. And we don't want to be silent either. I'm not saying that we should go hit the streets today and have a protest, but there's a war that's happening today. That war is for your heart and for your mind. There are people on the bad side and people on the good side. If you're a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ, you're on the righteous and good side. We can't embrace what this world has to offer us. We want to embrace God's truth. We want to embrace his righteousness, his foundation. Anything less than that, it's no good. So even though we're looking at history, at World War II, and it's a disturbing history where 60, 80 million people lose their lives. What about today? 1 Corinthians chapter 10 tells us that history is always a warning for those that live today. Looking back at how God dealt with people in the Old Testament for sexual immorality or whatever is a warning to the church. Hot topics from LGBTQ to the idea of transgender or abortion or euthanasia, we stand up loudly and we stand up clearly that those things are wrong. Abortion's evil. That's a moral decision. It's a moral judgment I just made from the stage right here. But your voice counts, and so does your silence. God, thanks so much for the lessons of history. Thank you for the lessons of World War II, and specifically the lesson of how people rise to positions of power. God, we want to be in the church starting there. We want to be faithful men who are pastors and leaders here. We want faithful church members that love you and love truth, are full of integrity and full of good, godly character. God, that's lacking today. And it disturbs us greatly. God, we look forward to generations to come, our children and our children's children, if you tarry, Lord. It's not a real good picture. God, let us be in the church in our small world that we impact a small group of people, Let us be faithful in this pulpit. Let us be faithful in this church, in this lampstand. And let us start one person at a time, one family at a time, one church at a time. God, we pray and we beg you for revival in this world, starting here in Aliso Viejo and spreading throughout the country or wherever you take it. We want to see men and women's hearts, one for you. And it's in your name that we pray. Amen.